You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 1st of July 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
If you're a politician, you're not paid to tend to your own feelings. You're paid to lay out your beliefs and convictions clearly. And that's what I did. And I was delighted that the public voted to leave the European Union. And I believe that whoever our next leader is should be someone who argued for that mandate, believes in that mandate, and can deliver that mandate.
Michael Gove stakes the Brexiteers' claim on 10 Downing Street. Have we heard from the next Prime Minister or an overreaching schemer? My guests Andrew Tuck and Matt Alagaya will be discussing that and some of the many, many questions raised by a very, very strange week, including, can London keep its status as a global financial centre?
In the coming years, the UK will redefine its openness to the movements of goods, services, people and capital. And in tandem, a potentially broad range of regulations might change.
Mark Carney of the Bank of England doesn't sound entirely convinced. Also, as Australians psych themselves up to wrestle with their serpentine voting slips in tomorrow's federal election, we'll look at the good and bad of ballot paper design around the world. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. Welcome to the show. My guests here in the studio right now are Monocle's editor, Andrew Tuck, and Monocle's business editor, Matt Alagaya. We will start here in the UK with all due acknowledgement that it's only 6 p.m. and anything could happen after everyone's had a few drinks. Today has been relatively sane by the standards of the last week or so, distinguished principally by someone who serially betrayed two of his closest friends and colleagues in order to seek the office of Prime Minister, giving a very long speech about how he never had any intention of seeking the office of Prime Minister. Andrew, first of all, what did we make of Michael Gove's quite lengthy, exhaustively detailed pitch, almost as if he hadn't just thought it all up in the last 24 hours?
Well, you know, he's set out his, you know, his credentials, his, you know, he's pitching himself as, you know, the man who is the architect of this, you know, along with Boris. But the way that he's dealt with getting rid of Boris Johnson, you know, first of all, we had this email earlier this week that was apparently by mistake sent by his wife, Sarah Vine, to a member of the public who somehow just knew who to send it on to, which managed to ruin Boris Johnson's career. So, you know, who knows how that miraculously all managed to happen in seconds in a way that was absolutely ideal for her husband. Now, I've got a feeling that the machinations around this, and remember that the majority of Tory MPs don't like what happened in that vote. So I don't think that there's any chance. You know, there are five MPs who turned up to support him at his speech. So it's all very well good. You know, he is a good orator. He is, you know, for want of a better word, a mean son of a bitch when it comes kind of dealing with departments, and people have kind of liked that. He's authoritative. He's, you know, he's good on detail. He's seen as the intellectual heft behind some of these moves. But I think that in the end, the Tory party would want to coalesce around somebody who they feel is one of them, who they can do business with, and who perhaps is a little bit more in the centre of all of the MPs, because they have to unify not just the country, but their party as well. And there are many, many rifts. So I think, you know, I think it's unlikely that he will carry the party. I think he's doing it probably to ensure that he has a key position when the dust settles, but I don't think that it's likely that the British public or his party will have any faith in him as a reliable character.
Matt, possibly for all those reasons, the bookies don't actually like him much. He's only 13-1 third favourite behind Theresa May and Angela Leadsom. Would it be weird, though, if Theresa May, who is now the odds-on favourite to be the next Prime Minister, would that be slightly strange and counterintuitive, given that she was you know, not ostentatiously and indeed suspiciously quietly, but nonetheless part of the Remain campaign.
Absolutely, and you make a valid point. I mean, she was very quiet about it. She was kind of Eurosceptic up until sort of about 3 months ago, I think, when she came out.
I was kind of wondering if this was... It struck me very much as the equivalent of John Major's famous toothache in 1992.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
1990 it was.
Yeah, and I think, to be honest, I think you're absolutely right that a lot of people in the Brexit camp will not trust her to be the one negotiating these deals on behalf of, you know, that Brexit mandate that they're always talking about. I think she's probably the best person to unite the party, as Andrew was saying, though, because she does have, you know, she's got enough kind of Eurosceptic background that people on the Brexit side might like her. And she's a Remainer, obviously, and has been in, you know, in the cabinet for many years now, and is a seasoned pro. And people think that she's quite a...
And let me just dive in here. The thing that I think is really fascinating is, you know, I think, I probably sit in the category that would be described as the London elite. I work in the media. You know, I have numerous friends who are not British, and I like the fact, I like the diversity of the city, and I have, you know, some options in my life that maybe other people don't have, and I recognise that. But, you know, in the end, 16 million people voted to stay in the European Union. Another 16 million people were apparently too busy to even go to the polls. We don't know what they really think. So when people keep on talking about, you know, the country has decided, the country has moved, we're talking about a constituency of a million people in the middle there who, if they'd moved 700,000 one way, would have stopped this happening. So it's not a huge leap. The country is properly divided. So in the end, it is good to have somebody who understands that pull from both sides of the argument. And the idea that we're going to get dumped with a politician who is so brutally Brexit and has no empathy for the other 16 million people is unfathomable and distasteful. And that is what is going to be interesting in the coming weeks, because at the moment they have been able to ignore a huge constituency of people who probably voted Tory last time, who run businesses and enterprises, who live in nice places like Barnes, and who are going to look at this lineup of characters and not like them. And unless we get somebody like Theresa May who can say to those people, look, I kind of understand this isn't kind of very easy for you, but we need to nudge you in a direction you're not very happy with, I think the Tory party, you know, all the parties are kind of done for, because it's great. They can rush around catering for this new constituency of, you know, the supposedly dispossessed. But actually, Nigel Farage and the Labour Party are in the end better at talking to them. If they turn their back on Middle England, which, you know, they will be doing in this process, then, you know, I think they're screwed.
Well, on the subject of screwed political parties, we should take a look at Labour, because that is always fun. Matt, Jeremy Corbyn, the nominal leader of the party, is still, he says, refreshing his browser, he's still the leader of the Labour Party. So much has gone on this week that it has baffled me completely. We are so far through the looking glass. I'm hoping at this point you might have a better answer to this question than I do. I cannot for the life of me fathom why Jeremy Corbyn hasn't quit. I don't understand what he thinks is going to happen. Do you?
I don't. And to be honest, I completely agree. I think he must be one of the most stubborn men in the entire world. I mean, his argument is that he has this mandate, which is from the members of the Labour Party. But you can't be the leader of a party, which is a parliamentary party, without your parliamentary members being with you. And the vast majority of them are not behind him now. And I mean, the way our representative democracy works, you cannot do that. I mean, you can't be at the head of a party that is not behind you. And I think it is just pure stubbornness at this stage that's keeping him there.
Andrew, I'm attempting some optimism here. Is there actually an opportunity here? You have a potential extraordinary head start for a new political party of 170 centrist left MPs who have voted no confidence in the present leader of the Labour Party. Should they basically just clear off and set up shop as they would become Her Majesty's loyal opposition by dint of the benches they command?
I'd like to say yes. I think there is I think on the left, as it were, of the Tory party, with the Lib Dems, with the SNP, with the real majority of the parliamentary Labour Party, you have a group of MPs who actually, if they were all in the same party, could do a damn lot of good. The trouble is that we have seen through the political history of Britain over the last 30, 40 years that when you have these fissures and people go off and start their own parties, they have a tendency to fall by the wayside. When we look at the power of the Liberal Democrats, you know, we reduce now to a handful of MPs after a disastrous coalition experiment with the Tories. You know, they kind of do speak to a lot of people, but they don't have the machinery. And in the end, for the Labour Party, that machinery, whether you like it or not, is the unions. It's the way that businesses, you know, connect via the unions with the Labour Party. So you go off and start something on your own. You don't have the buildings, the places to meet. All of those things are stripped away from you. And I think for me, I know for many of the people I speak to this week, what has been so utterly disgraceful is there is nobody in this damn country to rally behind. You know, all of the Tories are running around headless, fighting each other. The Labour Party is so riven with kind of bitterness and disappointment. There is not one character able to step forward. And even here in London, a city where we know how much needs to be fought for at this very moment, you know, I think Sadiq Khan is probably going to be a very, very good mayor. And he's made the odd speech, but he is not the rallying point. You know, there is a march tomorrow in London where we know that tens of thousands of people are going to attend pro-EU march. He should be there. He should be there leading the damn thing. And the silence from City Hall is, again, awful. So I think that most people are going home at the evenings with this terrible, terrible sense of there is nobody that I can look to for support.
A question I did want to put to you both, and I'll ask you first, Matt, following up from that. I mean, I've lived in this country for 26 years, which means I barely understand anything. But I have noticed, just talking to British friends of mine in the last week or so, last 8 days. And as you were saying, Andrew, earlier, I will also cop to being a member of the middle-class metropolitan media, etc., etc. I don't think, if I'm honest, anybody in my social circle voted Leave. I do know a couple who abstained for various reasons, but I don't think I know any Leavers, and I think that probably tells us something right there. I don't say that as a boast. I don't think it's a good thing. But Matt, has the last 8 days caused you to think differently about your country? I've spoken to a couple of people who said that they've only realised in the last 8 days how important to them their identity as Europeans was, as well as their identity as Britons, and they feel like that's been taken away from them.
Absolutely. I mean, that's certainly one side of it, that, you know, we had a march in favour of Europe in going through the streets of London the other day at Trafalgar Square. And, you know, you would not have seen that in years gone by. I mean, you know, I guess it's when something is threatened is when you really realise how much you value it. But the other thing that we've obviously, I think, as a country realised is how much our political establishment has not been connecting with a huge number of people for many, many years. I mean, you have to go back, 30 years potentially. There's a lot of people who are up in the sort of post-industrial north who feel like they haven't been represented by either New Labour or the Tory, you know, Tory Lib Dem coalition or the Tory government now. And I think, you know, we were pretty good at working out what the causes are behind, you know, Trump in the US. I think a lot of people have been talking about that. It feels like, you know, Brexit is Britain's Trump. It's the same kind of contingency of people who are voting.
I mean, Andrew, have you had that feeling of sort of waking up last Friday morning and feeling like you were looking at or living in a different country than the one you imagined you were?
I have it every single morning. I think, you know, and I understand that on the other side of this, you know, there are many people who have maybe felt disconnected from their country for a very long time. If they've lived in poverty, if they've lived in communities in the northeast where there is a lack of employment, maybe they feel that we're finally feeling what they feel. But I live in a street where my neighbours are Danish, Irish, French, Japanese, from all around the world. That is my London. And I'm damn proud of it. And the idea that these people think that they can come along and ruin that and stop that happening, I find an attack on me, an attack on everything that I believe. And you're right, that notion of, you know, your Europeanness has surfaced in me so strongly over recent days. You know, there are many of those people who are my neighbours, who are, you know, the Polish guy who works around the corner, who actually I have much more in common with than many of the people who are on the Brexiteer side. I hear some of the things that they say, and I hear some of the way that they question, you know, the idea of, you know, nationality and the ability to move across borders. And I don't see myself reflected in it. And, you know, and I'm, you know, I'm not alone. I know that amongst my friends, there is a real sense of, is this really where I want to spend the next 10 years? Now, when you think how many people are in this city generating money, tax revenues, employing people because they've come here from Germany, from Sweden, from Spain, and they have now started businesses. They didn't come here on some point system because they were some super clever clogs who had a load of money to invest. They came here with nothing and they started businesses, and now they're employing British people and they're running enterprises. I have a very good friend who came here from Spain who has just opened a very big business recently. But he worked for the first few years in Pret-a-Manger. He barely spoke English. He'd learnt on the job. He fought his way up. And it's those people that we need in this country. We need the people who have the energy and the guts to do things. And a points-based system is just going to exclude all of the people with the best energy. And it's insulting to London and it's insulting to Britain that somehow the conversation has been, you know, pushed down a side route to end up as something so horrible and so kind of negative.
Well, just a final thought from each of you on this. Do either of you perceive any kind of glimmers in the way forward? There's various talk and various theories circulating about some sort of fudge that might be confected between Britain and the EU. And the British do have a historical genius for fudge. Your relationship with the EU up until this point has been, in fact, one gigantic fudge, Matt.
Well, I think we don't know what the deal is going to be, and until we know, I'm living in hope that we're going to end up with a deal which, as Andrew said, you know, keeps freedom of movement and keeps, you know, cities like London going strong and attracting investment and new people. That's my hope, but again, we don't know how the negotiations are going to go.
I don't think at the moment there is much of a glimmer. It's too soon after the vote. We're only 10 days in, and in a way that the dismay and the disappointment and the upset of the people who have lost is sitting with them in a real kind of sense of, you know, depression. You know, somebody told me yesterday they went into an American bank here in London where there are thousands of employees, and he said the mood of depression, the way that people were just looking at their feet, the silence, he had gone there for a meeting where he said that actually people just weren't engaged. I think that collective depression across the city is fine for now, but actually we need to get cross, we need to get angry, and we need to do something about it. We have to fight this because this is wrong, and the only way that it will get corrected, unfortunately, is when finally in 6 months' time every company is saying, do you know what, my profits are down, we're moving our business to Europe, we're closing down the factory, there aren't the jobs anymore. And when the tax receipts go down and when the house prices crash, then finally the Tory party will wake up and they'll think, oh my god, we need to do something about this. And until we end up in the Greek position, let's remember what happened to Greece. So Greece was, you know, were they going to stay in the EU? Were they going to fall out of the EU? Could they keep the euro? How is it going to happen? In the end, all the European leaders, they were quite happy. They sat back. They went back to Berlin for the summer. They waited to see what would happen. They let them stew. And they let them wait. And they let them see their economy fall apart. And then at the final moment, they stepped in and they sorted it out. And that's what will happen to London. When London has lost its jobs, it's lost its wealth, then finally the Tories will think, oh my God, we need to do something about it. And at that point, finally, there may be some common sense. But until then, while, you know, we have a fake stock exchange price, that stock exchange price, don't get excited about that. That is because there's a misbelief in the city that there may be a deal. And when we see the lineup of candidates who are running for the Tory party, there is going to be no deal at the moment. It will only happen when we've suffered a bit. So that price is going to go down over the coming months as every single company tells you that they're making less money than they did the year before.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Miller, along with Andrew Tuck and Matt Alagaya. Coming up next, could London now cease to be Europe's financial hub? And if so, which city is the best place to succeed it?
Hurry, grab your popcorn. It's nearly showtime here on Monocle 24, but before the movie starts, let me tell you about our program dedicated to the best in film, The Cinema Show. Tune in every week to hear from filmmakers, critics and luminaries of the genre as we shine a spotlight on everything from revivals and the restoration of vintage cuts to European films and the role of the auteur.
I never think of architecture or cities or landscapes in cinema as merely being a kind of neutral backdrop to the action. They are the action themselves.
So whether it's the Oscar-winning film director Neil Jordan,
The truth is that writing a novel and directing a film, you can be as utterly alone in both activities, you know.
Or the renowned composer Michael Nyman.
When there's some strange kind of integration of what I do as a composer with what, on this occasion, I do as a filmmaker, you can't really take one thing away from another.
We've got the inside word on what to watch. The cinema show on Monocle 24 in association with Mubi, premiering Fridays at 20:00 London time, or catch up via the podcast. Quick now, find your seat. The movie's starting.
You're back with Midori House, with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Monocle's Andrew Tuck and Matt Alagai. We're also joined now by Monocle's executive editor, Steve Bloomfield. Now, Britain's decision to leave the EU is not merely a colossal self-inflicted headache for Britain. It guarantees 27 other member states years of uncertainty, upheaval, and perhaps even danger. It also, however, offers opportunity, principally in the shape of London's immense financial sector, which could well steadily migrate elsewhere over coming years. But where? Steve, seeing as how you're just here, I'll ask you first. We did have the head of the Berlin Stock Exchange on the Daily earlier this week, and rather reassuringly, he said he didn't actually see it. He talked about this ecosystem which has been built over many decades in London that he thought was actually too valuable to dismantle. Do you think it is actually that greater danger that large numbers of banks might up sticks?
Yeah, I don't share his confidence that London is going to be fine. There are two places to look at. One is Dublin, which has always tried to, with its a very low tax, low corporation tax, has tried to encourage companies to move there. The other is Paris. You may recall that a few years ago, when François Hollande was elected president of France and introduced a higher rate of tax for the for the more affluent in France, Boris Johnson, then mayor of London, said we're going to roll out the red carpet for French people who want to move to London. Well, that red carpet has been stolen by the French, and they are rolling it out right now. And it'll be very interesting to see what happens if, in the negotiations that eventually take place between the European Union and the UK, whether the European Union, pushed on by France, say, well, you know what, tell you what, you don't have to have freedom of movement, but instead of that, we won't let you have a control over services, and therefore we can make Paris a financial centre instead. That is not unlikely to happen.
Andrew, you were talking earlier about the leadership of Sadiq Khan, the mayor of London. Is there anything London can or should do to stop the exodus or discourage it?
Well, he went to meet Oliver Letwin today, who we know is going to be in charge of the this new kind of unit for Brexit. What a miserable job that's going to be. But anyway, he went to see him today, and he was campaigning or lobbying to say, you know, we need to ensure that the financial services stay. It's always comical that all the Labour Party hate all the bankers until they realise how much money they bring into the city and the nation. Even the Labour Party today, their deputy, their shadow foreign, their shadow chancellor was saying, we need to keep, you know, the bankers here. They all realise that in the end, that's where the cash comes from. I don't think it's going to be the kind of stampede to the door, but when you're a German bank or a Swiss bank here and you can actually have like 2,000 or 3,000 of your staff back in Frankfurt or back in Zurich, then of course that is going to be a temptation, and I'm sure that that will happen. But here's another intriguing thing, is that what's happened in Europe over the past few years with banking is that all these kind of, you know, back office services have moved to other countries. So if you go to Poland, if you go to Krakow, if you go to Warsaw, many of the big famous banks have all their back office services actually sitting there now. So they're kind of junior level people.
It would be a glorious irony, wouldn't it, if the upshot of all this is that Warsaw becomes Europe's new banking capital.
This is what's going to happen, because what you'll say is, okay, right, you know, we've got like 200-300 young Polish guys working in our office in London. They're going to have a really complicated time getting, you know, the paperwork done. Why don't we just let them go and work in Krakow? It's going to be cheaper. They'll be with our back office. So for like year one and two, why don't they work in Krakow? Why don't they work in Warsaw? And that is going to happen. So that junior level, they won't bother doing the paperwork, sending them to London. They'll say, let's keep them closer at home. Let's keep them in Frankfurt. Let's keep them in Poland. Let's keep them in Switzerland. And then we'll think about it when they get to a higher level. And we've got the time to do all the damn paperwork to get them into London.
Okay. Well, finally tonight, I wanted to move on to my own country, where polls are opening a few hours from now in Australia's general election. Now, this is especially exciting for ballot paper enthusiasts. There doesn't seem to be a Latin phrase for them. I did look. As the ballot paper relating to the Senate vote in particular is something of a collector's item. Australia's upper house has become something of a circus for minor parties, fringe groups, single-issue headbangers and out-and-out crackpots. Among the contenders this year are the Motoring Enthusiast Party, the Arts Party, who have their own poet in residence and therefore must be stopped, the Animal Justice Party, the Sex Party, the Cyclist Party and the Voluntary Euthanasia Party. Now, gentlemen, as you can see, the Australian Senate ballot paper is something of a production. On a scale of one to extremely, how baffled are you by this? This is life-size, okay. By the way. I realise that I'm having to describe this now to our listeners.
Oh, my God.
Hang on, this isn't like...
No, this is real. We're not making this up. This is...
I thought Andrew was going to, like, take one and pass it on, but actually this is the whole thing.
Yeah, you thought I was giving you one each. No, that is the whole thing.
How long are you in the voting booth for?
Longer than some governments in recent years have lasted.
That is crazy. So our listeners obviously can't see this. So it stretches across three sheets of A3, and then there is kind of like, you know, the horizontal line of parties, and then there's the candidates below, some of which run to the very bottom of the sideways turn piece of A3. In the end, it's like tiling a bathroom.
Who is? I have a question. Who is Derrin Hinch, and what is his Justice Party?
Well, that how do I describe Derrin? How would you put Derrin Hinch in British context? If you can imagine sort of Richard Littlejohn with a sense of social justice. And his own political party. That is basically what we're dealing with there. For American listeners, that's probably Glenn Beck without God.
Okay.
But I have also bought in, or we have had rather furnished by our researchers, a sheaf of ballot papers from around the world. I just want to talk about what works and what doesn't.
Okay, so my favourite of these is perhaps the most disastrous ballot paper in the history of the world.
At least until last Thursday.
No. At least that one was clear. Yeah. We don't know what leave meant, but leave was quite clear. This is the ballot from Palm Beach in Florida in 2000. This is known as the butterfly ballot paper. And what happened here is that you have a list of people on the left-hand side. Number one, George W. Bush. Number two, Al Gore. This is for president in 2000. And then you have a list of people on the right. Now, the leading one on the right is Pat Buchanan from the Reform Party, a very hard right, almost far right politician. But the way this is set up is that you will look at who's number two and think, oh, Al Gore, brilliant, I want to vote for him. And you'll push the lever for number two. But no, number two is actually the first person on the right-hand side. So what happened was lots of people voted for Pat Buchanan when they meant to vote for Al Gore, including lots of people who live in an old people's home, which was a Jewish old people's home. Pat Buchanan was, I think we can say, an anti-Semite of, you know, to a certain degree. They didn't want to vote for him. They won't vote for Al Gore. George W. Bush won by 537 votes, became president, and we were all screwed after that.
Matt, do you have any favourites there leaping out at you?
Well, I'm quite a fan of the Swiss one, actually, I have to say. That is very, very Swiss, very clinical. We've got just one question and then another box that says Antwort, which is the word for answer in Swiss German. And it's very clean. It's very nice. I'm quite a big fan of it, that. Have you done this one?
That's very nice. It's kind of like you're filling out your tax form. You're going to get a colonoscopy or something. It doesn't look
there's
very
no glam.
There's no fun there.
No.
I quite like the South African one, which I don't know what the literacy rate is in South Africa, but I presume that maybe there are some people who aren't good readers, because so they make it very, very visual. You get the logo of the party, you get a nice picture of the person you're voting for, so you can also guess whether you're voting for someone who's black or white, but I'm sure that's an aside issue. But I also like the fact that there's dozens and dozens of parties listed, one of which is called a party.
Yeah, I was wondering whether that was like a party, whether it was the A party. He was trying to make himself first in the list, like those people who call themselves Aardvark Plumbing, so they're first in the yellow pages.
Or do you think he just thinks come round my house tonight?
Maybe that's it.
I'll put the record player on.
Bring some cans and some sausages.
Actually, the logo thing is quite interesting, because that happened, like the number of elections I covered across Africa, where there would be, you know, each party had a very specific logo or colour, which
they made sure was on the ballot paper so that everyone, whether they could read or not, was able to vote the right way.
We will have to leave it there, unfortunately. That is all we have time for on today's Midori House. Thank you to Andrew Tuck, Steve Bloomfield and Matt Alagaya. Today's show was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Alice Tennant. Our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. There's more music next. At 1900, it's our food and drink show, The Menu, followed by The Cinema Show at 2000. And I'll have more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns the same time Monday, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. We'll be right back.